Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel.
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Okay, here we go. We're off and running. You can always tell, Rusty, when I raise my voice, okay, that we're off and running with another episode of The Suspendables. Just the fastest growing podcast in the north end of Edmonton. It's just fucking ripping along, Rusty. It's going crazy. No, we kid. Thanks, everyone, for supporting it and listening and sharing it with all your friends. And this week, Rusty, you know my favorite shows are when we have guests. And my all-time favorite guests are when we have someone on who, if you were around at the, if you played a bunch of hockey with this guy, that we would have heard stories how often that guy would have wanted to kick the fucking shit out of you, okay?
Fuck you.
When he played. We're very pleased. I always got a bunch of stats, right, when I'm going to read about this guy. But anyone who's our age or even older or even young in the game is going to know the name Chris Nyland. And Chris, welcome to the show. This must be a huge day for you, Nux.
Yeah, it is huge.
Yeah, it's staggering.
I appreciate you guys having me. Really? No, I do. Every time someone gets in touch with me to do one of these things, believe me, I know how difficult it is to get these things started, want to get it up and going and running and get people listening. And I try and help people out. So I'm glad to be here, to be honest with you.
Thanks, Nux.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I don't mean this a cliche, man. You've got an unbelievable life that you've led from all sorts of things. And of course, one of those would have been a year that you played with Russ. It might have been your last year, I think, that you played with Russ. Yeah. What we want to really know, how did you handle Cortinel? Because none of us can handle him. And how do you?
I'll tell you, Rusty's a great guy. He's a great team player. And I say that, and I was only there a short time. I came back, Serge traded me to New York, actually St. Louis.
Yeah.
And from Montreal. I was having a difficult time with the coach at the time, Perron, who was like dumb as a stump. And, you don't, like Bob Gainey put it best. He said, you don't always like your boss, have to like your boss, but you got to have that respect. And I have a hard time to respect somebody who doesn't respect me. And anyway, I got traded, go away. I end up in New York. I told Serge I wouldn't go to St. Louis. He traded me to St. Louis. I said, I ain't going to St. Louis. I want to be closer to home, Boston. I wanted to go to Boston. I knew Phil was interested in me. So I said, he wouldn't send me to Boston. So I went to New York. I was there, I had a crazy time with injuries, broke my arm a couple of times, hurt my knee, had the hockey hernia, all that happy horse shit. And then I went, ended up going to Boston, and I was there for like a year and a half. But my second year there was a nightmare. I was with Rick Bowness, who was kind, and Bones is a great guy. I really like him. Mm-hmm. But at that time, he was kind of listening. He had Harry in one ear and Mike Milbury in the other. And I like Mike Milbury, a lot of respect for all those guys. But I had an issue with the way Bonus handled me. And I had a tough time with that. Anyway, I reached out at one point to my friend in Montreal and said, geez, I'd love to come back there. Serge ended up picking me up off the waivers and letting me come back for the curtain call. Pat Burns was there. I was a perfect player for Pat Burns. He was in the minors when Serge traded me. Big mistake, Serge. I say that. And I might sound cocky, but they don't lose to Calgary like they lost to Calgary in '89 if I'm there. That's pretty pretty big statement, I guess. And people say you cocky fuck. But you know what? They didn't have anybody there that was unpredictable. They didn't have anybody there ready to do the shit that a lot of people, quite frankly, don't want to do. And right. I think
I was there, Nux. We would have won with you, pal.
Right? I'm telling you. I know I could have made some type of difference in that series. And anyway, but Rusty getting the opportunity to play with him instead of fucking chasing him around the rink like I did other times and not catching him. I always had the my motto was slash what you can't catch.
Did it fucking hurt? And usually it was at the face-off, because as soon as that puck dropped, I took off.
Slash what you can't catch. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, Nux, I played a lot of years against you, and I think a lot of people who love the Montreal Canadiens know the kind of player you were. But some fans out west didn't get to see you as much. But you probably played on maybe the best checking line in the NHL at that time with Guy Carboneau and Bob Gainey. Man, what a combination of three great players in different ways. And then we all know how fucking tough you were. Oh. Thank God I didn't fight, because I witnessed some of your fights from afar. Holy shit. Well, anyways, congratulations on a great career.
Yeah, well, listen, I appreciate that. And what you said there, Key, Gainey and Carboneau, two Hall of Famers. And honestly, like, I was always, like, a halfway decent hockey player. I wasn't a great hockey player. I wasn't kidding myself. But the one thing I would do was work my ass off. I'll outwork anybody. And I was fortunate to be in an organization like the Canadiens, because they didn't want me to just be a fighter. They wanted me to be more than that. Yeah. And they helped me to do that. But playing with those two guys was the best thing that happened to me in my career. Yeah. And you said the best checking line in hockey at the time. And it's funny you say that, because you if you ask Ken Linsman today who the best checking line was in hockey, he's going to tell you it was that line right there.
And 100%.
I remember Linsman said it the first time to me, and he said it in an interview, and I saw it in the interview first, and I'm like, wow, that's cool, Ken. Thanks. You
know? What a compliment from him.
Instead of getting a stick in the eye.
Well, he probably borrowed that thing, slash anything you can't catch, slash, you know, the rat, but, of course.
Again, those guys, they were awesome to play with. They helped me certainly understand that part of the game more, so I was able to play hockey. And honestly, I couldn't have done the fighting job if I didn't play. I would have never been the guy that you, okay, go out there. I couldn't have done that. No. As much as I love my teammates and I would do anything for them, if I ain't playing, man, it's so difficult. I couldn't do that job. But those guys helped me.
How long can I call you Nux?
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Oh. Yeah, that's fine.
We had Sean Payton on, Nux, and he was calling him Jimmy, and then Jimmy told a story and he went back to Jim.
He said, no, pal.
Anyway, sorry, go, Jimmy. Sorry,
you're not doing that. How long are you sitting around Chris, I've got the very accurate Wikipedia here. Okay. Yeah. By the way, you can't tell by your accent that you're from Boston. It's really hard to.
That's good. I've been really trying to shake that for years.
New York.
It doesn't work. No, yeah, it's nothing like New York.
No, accent. No, it's not like New York. It's good. It's good. How long were you sitting around when I read some of these stats? The one that there's tons of shit here, you know, that sticks. I mean, you got the most penalty minutes by an American hockey player. 3,000 penalty minutes, Russ. I don't even fucking think I've lived for 3,000 minutes. I can't. I'm trying to do the math. But you were drafted. What sticks out? You were drafted 231st overall. I mean, the draft, if it started on a Monday, you probably would have had to wait till Thursday till they got through it all. Did you ever think it was going to happen?
I've been sitting there with four other guys behind me, right? Because it was 235 that year, and I was 231. Yeah. Yeah, all I needed was an opportunity, and it's funny how I got it. I was playing at Northeastern, and a coach of mine growing up was Judge Paul King. He was a district court judge in a really violent section of the city called Dorchester. Mm-hmm. And the judge had 7 kids. He had arthritis. He was hunched over. And he was down there coaching us as bantams and midgets. And this guy saw something in me. I don't know what it was, but he saw it. And he absolutely loved me. And the judge happened to be very good friends with Dickie Moore. He was a hockey fan, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And he loved coaching. But he was good friends with Dickie Moore and Doug Harvey. When I was at Northeastern, he had talked to Dickie and Doug. And Doug was scouting at the time. And he asked them just to draft me. Just draft this kid. Do me a favor so we can go to training camp. And, you know, it'll be play nicey-nice. But I found out after the judge died that he told Dickie Moore, he said, just draft him. I'm telling you right now, and he'll do the rest. That's how much this guy thought of me. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
I got drafted not because, and I know Richard Scammell was a scout, and he went down and saw me and all that. But they drafted me with their last pick there because it was a favor to Paul King, the judge.
Wow.
And Dickie and Doug Harvey got that done. And I'm forever grateful for that. So imagine they go in and tell Sam Pollock, draft me. He wasn't around to see me. I'm sure he heard of me afterwards. But yeah, like it was a favor. I got drafted on a favor.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I wonder who the judge got bailed out.
Probably Doug. I would say Doug.
Remember that assault charge in the bar in Boston?
Oh yeah.
It's gonna come back to haunt you if you don't pick my boy.
Yeah. That makes it an awesome story, right? Your career. That I didn't know you're 4 guys away from getting salt mined.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, talk about stories. Like I remember, you know, the year before, I was watching the Canadians on their way to their 4th cup in a row in Boston, watching practice after practice. Well, I go into practice and I went up to Claude Ruel. I was with a buddy of mine, Franny Flaherty, and he said, hey, let's go to the next game in Montreal, see if you can get tickets. Fuck, they drafted you, asked them. So I go up to Claude Ruel and I said, Mr. Ruel, you know, I was drafted by you guys. I'm wondering if I go to the next game in Montreal, I want to get a couple of tickets. He's like, I don't do this. See that man over there.
Yeah.
So I walk over and it's Howard Grumman. Irving Grumman was the GM. He took over Sam. And he was the road secretary. So he took care of all the rooms, all that stuff. So I go up to him and I said, Howard, I said, Chris Nyland, I said, I was drafted by you guys. I'm just wondering if I could get a couple tickets to the next game up in Montreal.
Right.
He goes, you were drafted by us? I said, yeah. I must have looked like a fucking hoodlum or something. But he takes out the fucking guidebook.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's flipping through it and he gets to 1978 and he goes down. He sees that, okay, you were drafted. And he says, okay, I'll leave a couple tickets for you the next game in Montreal.
That's unbelievable.
We come out of the building. We watch the practice. We come out of the building. And there's Lafleur, Lupien, and Jacques Lemaire. Stand there looking for a cab. They're standing around outside Boston Garden. Franny had an old 78 T-Bird. It was freaking gorgeous. Big boat, right? And he said, let's give him a ride. Let's give him a ride to the hotel. I'm like, whatever. So we pull up. And we're all standing there, you know, flowers smoking a butt. And Franny goes, you guys want to ride the hotel? And they kind of look at each other. And they're with Loopy, so they're fine. Yeah, they get in. So they all jump in the back seat. And we're talking. Franny's like, you guys are playing great, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, this guy here, he's a hockey player. And I said, yeah, I got drafted by you guys. I'm going to be up there next year at training camp with you. And Lemaire goes, and I'm all proud and shit. You know, I'm going to. And Lemaire goes, oh, you were drafted by us, right? And I said, yeah.
Does nobody know you were drafted? What the fuck?
I play at Northeastern here in Boston. And none of them ever heard of fucking Northeast. And they go, so you were drafted. What round were you drafted? I said, 17. And the fucking three of them start laughing their balls off. What are they laughing at? I was drafted. Like, I didn't understand. I didn't know anything about the draft. I didn't. Okay, I do now. But then I was the first guy picked. I was 231. I might, we're the same. You know,
good for you.
I just got picked. I didn't know. And so we drive in the hotel and shit. Franny and I, we drive up to Montreal the next day. We get to the, before the game, well, the game was the next day. We drove up the next day, and the following day the game was. So I run down, go to Will Call. I said, hey, tickets for Chris Island. Show him my license. The lady goes back, gets a ticket. She comes back. That'll be $270.
No.
I swear to God. I didn't have, fuck, I was a college kid. I didn't have $270. Franny popped out the credit card, thank God, and bought the tickets. But they fucking made me pay for the tickets.
The cheap pricks.
Things have changed, and yeah, those guys know who the fuck you are now, Knuckles.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. Like, come on. Like,
yeah. They made me pay for
the tickets, the bastards.
Or at least 50% off. At least charge the guy a C-note or something. You know?
But that's I found out there, that's the difference between a first rounder and a 17th rounder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hopefully when you signed, you got that money back.
No. Well, yeah.
How much did you sign for?
I think it was my first year, and I was on a 2-way, 17-5 in Halifax, and I got a $2,500 signing bonus, and it was $60,000 in Montreal.
Wow.
Yeah. We interviewed, he's a friend of the shows, as we say, Larry Robinson. He was about 6-7 years ahead of you. Mm-hmm. But I think he started in 72, and he was telling us, Nux, that whatever his salary was, 25, 30 grand a year, that when he played for the Montreal Canadiens, he had a summer job paving highways.
Back at the beginning.
Yeah. Did you?
Larry.
Did you ever have any other jobs?
Me?
Yeah.
My first year?
Yeah.
In my second year, I worked construction back in Boston. I worked at Jackhammer for 2 summers.
Wow.
Because I worked for this guy when I was in college, and he was an awesome guy, and I didn't want to quit on him, and then I, you know,
exceptional.
After the second year, I said, you know what? That's it for me. I'm going to save my hands for more important things.
Yeah.
Knox, when Jeff played, my brother Jeff played in Boston.
Yeah.
His rookie year, he was the lowest paid guy in the NHL, 65 grand.
Oh, unbelievable.
He has the record for the Courtnell family.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Chris, talk about, you know, Russ talks about the toughest guy he ever played with, you know, was Wendell, and yourself always comes up there. And one of the toughest roles, man, in pro sports and pro hockey has got to be the tough guy. Walk us through that, Chris. At what point when you did get drafted, which is a huge day, how you were going to stay in the NHL, what you needed to do? Rusty always said everyone comes in thinking they're going to score 50. All the time, you know, a lot of young guys, but walk us through that whole deal where you're going, okay, fuck, is this really my role? Is this really what this is going to be?
I honestly, I'm going to say it now. I know a lot of people like, you know, how could you like, I loved what I did. I loved sticking up for my teammates. I was that way as a kid with my family members. I was that way with my friends on the street corner. You know, when I came in, college kid, right? Bert Templeton was my coach, my first year pro.
Right.
Okay, down in Halifax. And Bert was, you know Bert? He was the coach. Remember the big fight over in Russia? That was Bert.
That's him. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he had Al C. Coyd. He had all them guys in junior. He always had tough teams. He loved tough teams, and he loved tough guys. He hated college kids, right? So, I'm at my first fucking training camp down, and they brought him in because the year before, Maine kicked the shit out of the Nova Scotia Voyagers in the playoffs. They spooked them out of the building, beat them 4 straight. They had no tough guys. So they made a concentrated effort to get bigger. They drafted Alan Luchu, big defenseman, Dave Allison, big D-man. myself. They had another guy there, French guy, Gaetan Rochette, the Rocket. Anyway, I come to training camp, and I remember, you know, here I am. I didn't have a clue about pro hockey. I watched the Bruins. I loved the Bruins. I loved the fight and all that stuff. Anyway, and I fought as a kid growing up on the street. And, you know, I get to Halifax, and my first practice, Burke comes in the room, and Timmy Burke, assistant GM in San Jose, was, you know, from around Boston. And Berkey took me under his wing, and he said, listen, this coach hates fucking college kids. So just keep your mouth shut, get the end of the line, watch the drills, do what he says, blah, blah, blah. First practice, we go out. Well, before we get in the ice, he tells us all the rules, no smoking in the room, this and that. So I'm like, okay, all right, got it. So we go out on the ice, and I'm skating around. And, you know, a few guys are trickling out here, and I'm skating around. I fucking smell cigarette smoke. Yeah. Wow, that's awfully strong to be here. Maybe somebody up in the building smoking. I'm going, and I look, and there's a fucking goalie, Maurice Barrette, skating around, smoking a fucking cigarette.
No, he's not.
I swear on my
fucking slapshot.
I swear to God, Mo Barrette. So I'm skating next to him, and he's looking at me. I'm looking at him. I go, what are you doing? Fucking smoking on the ice. He said, the coach said no smoking in the room, not on the ice. And I'm like, really? Anyway, then we come out for practice, and there's a kid, Richie Costello, drafted out of Merrimack College. And we're like the only two Americans other than Timmy Burke. And we're doing Burke calls a drill, and Richie's first in line, wants to be good college kid, front row, and he fucks the drill up. And Bert Templeton says, he stopped, he blows the whistle, fucking Costello, you fucking idiot. You fucking college kids are supposed to be smart, you fucking dumb fuck. Now get at the end of the line. Well, that fucking kid, I'm telling you, I felt so bad for him. He near shit his pants. He got the end of the line. He was traumatized the rest of the fucking day. He was gone the next day. See you, Rich.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I'm getting the back of the line. But, I remember we were in Bathurst, Nova Scotia, or New Brunswick, Bathurst, wherever the fuck it is, somewhere. And we're in an exhibition game, and the guy in the other team is Bam Bam Belanger. Bam Bam. his fucking head is big as my house, right? And we're out there playing. I starting to play physical, running guys. And he comes in. I went to the net. I bump the goalie. He comes in, start pushing. I push him back. And the refs get in, break it up. We go back to the bench. And Dave Allison leans on the bench. He leans and looks at me. He said, hey, fucking college kid. You ever been in a fucking brawl before? You trying to start a fucking brawl? I'm like, hey, fuck you. You don't know what a brawl is, you fucking idiot. back ass with Canadian, you. And fucking Bert's behind me, like he's loving it, right? And so, boom, I go out the next shift, and who they put Bam Bam right out there against me, we drop him right away. I fucking give it to him.
Yeah.
Now, Dave Allison, of course. Ooh, college? So boom, we're still in training camp. I don't say a fucking word to him. I'm not gonna talk to him. Fuck you. Treat me like that. And didn't say a word to him. And then I end up making the team. I was on a 5-game tryout, $200 a game.
Unreal.
So Redzi calling, and I like Redzi now, but I was giving him the cold shoulder. You wanna fuck with me? Fuck you.
Yeah.
So we were in a bar one night, the jury room, and he, before the opening game of the season, he come up and he said, geez, I didn't know. I said, fucking right, you didn't know. College kid, fucking moron. Anyway, we go. Here's the deal. I get the 5-game tryout, play the first 3 games in Halifax. Next game is on the road in Maine, baby.
Oh, there we go.
My father, everybody comes up from Boston, right, to Maine, Portland. Yeah, they're going to cheer on Knuckles' first NHL game, first AHL game, pro game. And I go out and fucking run. Who do I run? Glenn Cochran.
Oh, Glennie.
Glennie, baby. So Glennie, baby, turns around, chops me, and he drops the glove. So I drop him right away.
Holy
and away
fuck. We go,
and boom, I fucking hit him this under this eye. And I fucking zipped him open, bleeding. Fuck, he goes nuts, trying to get break it up. Boom. Get kicked out of the game, both of us. My father comes down and goes, what the fuck? You know, he just paid all his money for ticket. I didn't. I said, fuck, I don't know. This is fucking pro hockey, I guess. I mean, here's what I'm doing. What I'm doing now. So wouldn't you know, the next day, I'm in the room. I wake up. We're going to go down and get the bus. And Bert calls me. He says, hey, Beaner. He called me Beaner. Hey, Beaner.
Boston guy.
Yeah, up, right. He goes, do you have an agent? And I said, no. Fuck, why? He said, well, you better get one. He said, because the Canadians want to sign you to a contract. Now, one fight, I had a contract the next day.
Wow. Glenn Cochran. Fuck, he's engaged to my sister.
Yeah.
I watched him. Yeah. And he played for the Victoria Cougars. He was like a big brother to me, but fuck, was he tough. So yeah, that's why that you fucking beat him. Oh my God.
He made my bacon, baby. Glenn Cochran, he got my foot in the door. That was the fight. And I hit him with a great punch. I caught him. I cut him open. And it was history.
That went around the league like wildfire. Because yeah, Glenn Cochran was supposed to be one of the toughest guys in the NHL at that time.
Yeah.
And was going once, to be.
Yeah. Once they found out that happened,
yeah,
I was fighting every guy every night. I mean, come on, I played 49 games there. I had 15 goals and 10 assists in 49 games. Wow. And I had 304 minutes in balance.
I know, I saw
every fucking night I was fighting. Every guy going to try me.
I'm going to toot your horn one more time, Nux. You're way underrated as a player. You had more skill than people probably gave you credit for. And I know that because I played against you. I played with you for a little bit in Montreal. And you know, you wouldn't have played with Carbo and Bob if you couldn't carry the puck. Well, and you could do more than that. So you were that doesn't surprise me that you had 50. And when you're tough like you and tough like Wendell, you get room. You get that room to make the plays. Anyways, that's awesome. What a great freaking story that is.
Right, so I got a pile of them. Fuck,
well, that's what we're all about, man.
Yeah.
Dave Semenko, God rest his soul, died too young.
Yeah.
No one really knew this. I knew Dave well. We were good friends. And I didn't believe him when he said he never fought in elementary school. He never fought in high school. He never fought after that. The first fight he ever had was in a hockey game. You know, he didn't get bullied. He wasn't, you know, he didn't bully guys. Russ and I come from pretty soft cities, man. I'm an Ottawa guy. Russ comes from Victoria. Can you talk about your life growing up as a kid? Because, Boston, right? One of the sections of Boston, like you said, are, you know, the toughest cities in the world. And you're from there. Did you fight your way through your whole childhood or how did it all start for you?
Yeah, you know, maybe a little more than some kids, but then maybe not as much as some other kids. But, you know, I grew up in West Roxbury section of Boston. There was South Boston, Charlestown, West Roxbury, and they were all predominantly Irish neighborhoods. And when you grow up in that environment and you know, everybody's trying to kind of get over on you. Everybody's trying to get an edge on someone. And it's just, you know, you have your loyalties to your friends and your family, and loyalty is a big thing there. And you know, because of that, and, you know, the nature of growing up in the city, having that streetwise city tough personality, you know, to navigate the streets and navigate your way around that city and with people, you got to be able to stand up for yourself. And I did. I did quite a bit. It's funny, you know, my dad was tough on me. And, you know, I had certainly had my share of problems as a kid, arrest and stuff like that. And my dad was a Green Beret. He was Special Forces. He just passed away in November 30th, and God rest his soul, he was tough on me. And I knew one thing, like, for me to live in my house back in Boston, I certainly had to take that from my dad. I did. I took the discipline, but I promised myself, when I go out that fucking front door, nobody is going to fucking lay a hand on me. No. Right. And that's how I was. That's how I operated. And with my friends, you know, we go to clubs in town, we're in fights, and like, you know, all the stupid shit. But that's when you're a kid, you know, usually when those fights happen, happens a lot of stupid macho bullshit or there's alcohol involved.
Nux, do you remember a kid in your neighborhood, Jim Strandberg?
Nope.
So Jim Strandberg's a good friend of mine. He married a great gal from my hometown, and I met him working in Hawaii. And he was a neighbor of yours, and he just tells some awesome stories about growing up and having to walk by your fucking front door. And well, here's a cool story. He ended up in the Navy and became an engineer, and he developed the ballistic missile system. And
Jesus.
Yeah, he Strand Technology, and he's obviously done extremely well, and he's bought some property in Hawaii. But what a great guy. And one day I got to introduce you to, because you guys,
I'd love to meet. Yeah. Is he still there?
Oh, he lives in Boston,
yeah,
Florida and Hawaii. And they're just a great family. We've become very, very good friends. And he, every time I'm with them, we talk about Nux.
It's funny. Like, my girlfriend's from Kona, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
And I heard you over there, Cabo, someone told me. And anyway, you know, I play golf a few times. I wonder if Rusty's out here today. I didn't have your number at the time. I got it from someone. But yeah, I was like, fuck, I'd love to play golf with you. Because when I go over there, it's like, you know, I don't know a lot of people. And Jamie's dad was there. And I took him up to Narnia to golf one day.
Nice.
Yeah, he was shocked because he never played there. And I'm, you know, how the hell did you get on this course? I said, Mike, come on. And he's a hell of a golfer and just thoroughly enjoyed every fucking blade of grass on that golf.
No kidding.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Wow. How does a guy in Boston meet a girl 7,000 miles away in Hawaii?
I got sober.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, there you guys got something in common.
Yeah.
That's two things. Fired by the same guy.
Yeah, fired by the same sober guy. Yeah. Chris, yeah. I'm a 12-year clean and sober guy. And
God bless you.
Are you okay to talk about that, Chris?
Yeah, yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, there's your battle with booze and drugs and heroin addiction, it says. How did you come through it? How did you handle it? How did you begin to tackle it?
Yeah, it was really just a terrible time in my life. But it is my life. It was part of my life. And I certainly understand it now. But listen, I grew up drinking all the time. Drinking was a big part of the game, right? Work hard, play hard. Did that my whole career. I wasn't into drugs during my career. A couple times in the summertime, when I was home in Boston, I did cocaine.
Right.
But never during the season. It'd be, you know, it'd be friend in the summertime, be out late and just wanted to drink from when the bars closed from 2 to at least 8 in the morning, you know.
Yeah. Prime time, baby.
Stay awake so I can enjoy that fucking 50th beer.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of got carried away with the booze at time, but I think I got a little crazy when I drank. And part of getting honest with yourself is really taking a good look at that. And I did, but it took me a while to really understand it. And I did, but you know, a lot of people look at the heroin addiction and they're, oh my God, he, you know, put a needle in his arm and he did that. Listen, I'm not minimizing it. I'm not saying it, but when you look at, and I understand how I got there now, like I had numerous surgeries. I've had over 30 surgeries on my body. Yikes. I had a big surgery in high school when I was a kid, on my knee. I had all my cartilage taken out of my right knee. And I remember being on Demerol in the hospital. I was in there for a week. I was on Demerol probably to the before the day I get out. I remember how it made me feel.
Fuck. Love Demerol.
Right. It hits those endorphins in your brain and forget about it. And then I remember I broke my leg when I was 5 years old skiing. My dad took me skiing. I broke my leg and I had a compound fracture in my tibia. And I was in the hospital overnight and they had to, they didn't have a doctor to set it that night because I get in there like 10:30 at night. So I had to stay overnight and they gave me painkillers. And I remember as a little boy, like I to this day, I remember how it made me feel. And I was able to sleep. I got through it in the morning. Anyway, so I look and I'm not blaming it on that. It's just that's how far back it goes. And right. Then when I started, I remember the first time during my NHL career was back in Montreal. I was going to the net, playing with the Rangers, and I was going for a puck, and I tripped over Patrick's left pad. And I went forward. I was going into the post, and I put my arm up, and I snapped my ulna bone. Well, I got up. I got back to the bench, and I'm sitting there, and I don't know, my teammate Jan Eriksson, he looked at me, he said, "Noxie, you're turning green."
Green.
Jesus.
And then I just threw up on the bench. So I sat there for about, there was like 6 minutes left in the game. I went in the room. Boom. I go to the hospital, compound fracture. They're going to put me in a cast, but I have to stay in Montreal for like 5 days. Mm-hmm. And I'm there, fuck that. I don't want to stay here 5 days. You know, I love Montreal, but I wasn't here anymore. It almost broke me when I got traded. And my arm was fucking killing me. So I couldn't fly if they put a cast on it. So they just wrapped me with an ace and they gave me a ball of Percocet. Boom, I remember taking them that night. Oh, it killed the pain. I flew home the next day, killed the pain. And boom. After that, I didn't take any more opiates when I played hockey. When I retired and I started having surgeries, I started taking the opiates. And it went from Percocet to eventually to Oxycontin.
Oh, God.
And then Oxycontin, the addiction. And I didn't understand it. I didn't know that, you know, when I was taking them, I start with taking one Oxycontin, boom, every 8 hours. Then I'm taking two every 8 hours. Then for the progressive part of the disease. And it just got worse and worse. And it got out of hand and way out of hand. And I was so addicted. I was crushing them, snorting them. And then when they made that big, and people say, oh, just stop. Fucking, you cannot stop.
Oh, man.
It's like when you're an alcoholic and you drink and you see people drink like they drink. And it controls their life and hurts their life. No, just stop. It doesn't work that way. Believe me. It'd be nice just to be able to do that. I try to stop the pills and I try to stop my own. And I'm going to tell you, I lasted to the fourth day. I was so, and I'm pretty strong-willed. I was so sick. I felt like I was going to die. I had joint pain. Mm-hmm. I was shitting myself, like puking. Like it was the worst feeling anybody could feel. And I got to tell you, the only thing that takes it away is more opiates. And that was at the time when Oxycontin, now they were cutting down on it, cutting back on it. And I didn't have any. I was out of it. And I called this kid that usually does it and he got me the other shit. And I snorted it for about 5 days. And then I ended up doing something I said I'd never do. And I did it. Listen, I had to deal with the shame and the shame of, being a drug addict at the time and afterwards and the guilt of all that. But, you know, I understood it and I was able to turn my life around and get back on my own 2 feet with help. NHL helped me big time. Get me into treatment.
That's great.
Paying for my treatment. And, you know, it's easy to badmouth the NHL and the referees and they suck. This one sucked. That one sucked. But they have been there for a lot of guys that certainly need it. And for me, I'm grateful that, you know, Brian O'Neill helped me. Dr. Shaw, Dr. Lewis, Dan Cronin. They've been really just awesome guys in my life to help me get my life turned around. But yeah, it was a difficult time. And I look at it, listen, I'm grateful today. And I understand that alcoholism and drug addiction, but it's really helped me to become a better person in my life. I wasn't living life right. You know, I was living wrong. And when you're messed up all the time, you don't care about those things. And I'm not that type. Honestly, I'm not that type of person. I at heart, I'm a good person. I'm willing to help anybody. And I wasn't being that. You know, I wasn't being a good husband. I wasn't being a good father. And I was ashamed of all that. And quite frankly, you know, that kept me messed up even more. Right. Like, I was so disgusted with myself that I didn't want to feel myself. I didn't. And, you know, again, I'm grateful I turned my life around. I love my life today. And, you know, if people say, oh, God, and it's so bad, you shot at him and you did. Listen, it's a part of my life, like hockey was a part of my life. And, you know, I'm not ashamed of it anymore. It happened to me, and I got where I got. And I found my way out of it with some help.
You know? Well, Knox, you know, a lot of the guys in the NHL know that you're a tough son of a bitch. But so many people who know you know how big a heart you have. And when I got to Montreal, at Christmas time, Jim, we went over to Sick Kids with all these toys. And I'm like, fuck, this is so awesome. And Knox started that. He went around all these toy companies in Montreal and he got them to donate. And then he made all his teammates at Christmas time go over to the Sick Kids and visit all these kids.
Pretty cool.
And he did it.
I can hear you getting emotional, Rusty. I can hear you getting emotional.
You know, and now the whole NHL does it.
Right.
And it's all because of him.
How come tough guys are such the nicest guys? How come they're the softest guys?
I think some people might not think so, but that's okay. I'm secure in who I am and what I've done in my life and what I'm doing now. So it doesn't bother me. But I just think, you know, I remember a few years back, those guys were dying, Wade Belak, Derek Bougaud, all these guys. I mean, there was a rash of them, right? And everybody's trying to draw the straight line from, you know, them dying to they were fighters in hockey. You know, when someone overdoses or someone dies from something like drugs or alcohol, it encompasses their whole life. And when you look at addiction and alcoholism, a lot of times, if you go back in someone's history, there's some type of childhood trauma. And when those traumas occur, a lot of times as young kids, not almost 100% of the time, we don't understand why that happens. And it stays with us our entire lives. And I know in my own case that it did. And it served me well. It fucking served me well in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But when I had nothing to do with that, it didn't anymore. And I didn't like the way I felt. I didn't like the feeling, and I still didn't understand it. And I had to do something about it. So I numbed myself. I didn't like the way I felt. I didn't understand it. When I was able to make it real again and understand it, and with some very good therapists, man, it was such relief to be able to let all that shit go. And I did. And there's a lot of people out there still suffering, and you know. People don't look at people who are alcoholic or drug addicts. They look at it like it's a moral issue and you're doing it to yourself. Wake the fuck up. Mm-hmm. Well, it's more than that. And we look at people have cancer, they have different diseases, and we all have sympathy for them. And we want them to get better and we wish them well. When we see the drug addict or the alcoholic, it's like, fucking wake up.
Right.
So, until you really understand it, a lot of people have been touched by this disease. And I if you're not an alcoholic or you're not a drug addict, you sure as hell know someone is. And sometimes those tentacles reach out and they affect you. And for me, I'm so glad I was able to get sober. You know, my youngest daughter has struggled at times, and you know, it's painful to watch. It's a family disease. And anyway, so.
Well, good for you, Nux.
Yeah. You know, someone, and well said, man, if it was easy as just telling a guy, hey, fucking wake up. I mean, there wouldn't be any problems.
Yeah. Right?
There'd be no problems, you know, and someone to explain addiction, Rusty, I'm right where you are, Chris. I went through it, you know, coke addict and boozer my whole life. And, someone said, here's how addiction works. If you smoke, for example, and I went and took your cigarettes away from you. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, for the first 5 minutes, the guy'd be, hey, that's pretty funny. You know, just, but give them back. Right. And you'd go, no. Remember, we're not going to do it. 10 minutes later, the guy, okay, that's enough. You idiot. Give me back those smokes. Yeah. Half an hour later, he'd be raising his voice going, hey, give me back my smokes. And an hour and a half later, he'd have you on the fucking ground, throat punching you, going, where's my smokes? Right. Right. And that example, I always,
that's what it does to you.
Yeah, that's what it does to you. Yeah. We're not bad people and made us do bad shit, but not bad people, right? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about post-hockey. I love our connection. As we said earlier, we both got fired by the same company. You got fired for a different reason, though. I got fired because I was high and drunk on air. Not really. I got it cut big cutbacks, but talk about that. Why you got let go from, you're a TSN guy. Right, your last gig.
Yeah, Bell Media.
Yeah, before that though, why have you settled in Montreal? By the way, that's interesting.
Well, after I get sober, and Rusty knows Mitch Melnick. Mitch been on the radio. You know who he is. I've been on the radio for years.
Here. I do. Yeah,
wonderful show. And Mitch, I did a couple hits for him when I got sober. He'd want to come on the show and once a week talk about the Habs, the games. I'm sure. So I did it. And he said, you know, and when you're in a situation like I was in, there's not many people out there saying, hey, Nux. And I understand it.
Right.
By the way, I'm going to extend my hand and we'll give you a shot. Yeah, there's not many people willing to do that. And right. Mitch was that guy who was willing. And I absolutely love him for helping me. But I really liked Mitch before that. So, you know, we were friendly and I got that opportunity. I moved back here and they didn't think I was gonna. Like, I remember having the interview with Wayne Buse and Mitch, and I had left. And Mitch had told me afterwards, after that interview, he walked away with Wayne. And Wayne said, he ain't fucking moving back here. Why would he leave the States, you know? Fuck, Biden wasn't even there yet, by the way. Well, he was, but he wasn't the fucking president.
Right.
Fucking numbskull. So I ended up coming back, and I moved back, and he was like, whoops. Wayne was like, whoops, oh, shit, he's back. So I ended up getting my foot in the door. I had a, you know, it was tough time starting. I was really... I wasn't green. I was rotten. Right. Oh, yeah. It was so hard, man. I was looking at the clock, you know, this segment, how am I going to hook the next one? I didn't know any of that shit. And right. Mel just took the training wheels off and said, just go, you'll be fine. I was like, but I had a good friend in Sean Campbell who really helped me through it all. And we came to have a pretty good goddamn show in the middle of the afternoon. And I enjoyed it. And, Sean was a big part of it off the cuff. And, you know, I ended up getting, I went to Quebec Pee Wee tournament, came back from there. And I wasn't right away, but I wasn't feeling well. I ended up having flu-like symptoms. I got headache, body aches, had a temperature. And I'm like, okay. I got tested. I had COVID early on.
Right.
And, I have had some health issues with clotting, with infection and different things. When I spoke with my doctor that I said, I don't feel comfortable taking this shot. I just don't. I lost my job and I had to move on. And listen, it hasn't been easy, 64 years old, trying to start over at this age. But like anything in my life, I'm going to go after it and do the best I possibly can to get my head back above water. Listen, I'm not crying here. I'm not fucking whining. I lost everything. And a lot of it is due to the way I was living my life, my alcoholism and drug addiction. And I had to start all over again. And I did. And I climbed myself out of the hole. And I battled my way back to, I was renting a house. I had a borrowed car. I had a bag of fucking hockey bag full of clothes. And I was living at my dentist condo here in Montreal, Zane, who gave me a place to live till I got back on my feet. I chipped away. I rented a little house in Dorval. I went from renting a house to I ended up buying a house couple back in 2017. And I got my life going in the right direction. So I couldn't be happier.
Good for you, Nux. Well said, and we're proud of you.
What would you get into coaching, Chris, to talk about what you would do, what you'd like to do?
Too late for that, don't you think, Jim?
Yeah, it's an age thing now.
Yeah. I coached, I coached in Jersey 1 year with LaMere, mm-hmm. and as an assistant. And then it was a year after the cup, and fuck up. I got fucking chopped right out of there quickly by Lou, because fucking Danico and McLean fucking hated me because I.
Oh no!
Oh yeah, no. It wasn't good. But anyway, I never had any confrontation with them when I was there. I did my job, and I ended up being a head coach in the East Coast League, where I had an expansion team. And I really loved the coaching. I did. I loved it. I won Coach of the Year my first year in the coast.
Nice.
And I liked it. But then after 2 years and right around in Chesapeake, the team moved to Jackson, Mississippi. And man, you got to be coupled up with someone who's moving too. So they take you with them.
Right.
And I wasn't. And, I stepped away from it and I got out of it. Just, I loved coaching. But at this point, honestly, if I coached today, I think I'd be firing them fucking iPads up in the balcony. That's what they do. They come off the fucking bed. They come off the ice, and they're fucking like this.
Oh, my God. And then how about covering their mouth when they're talking? Like we're fucking got reed lippers up in the lip readers up in the fucking... Oh my Great. God, these guys, when they cover their mouths with their little fucking pieces of paper, I'm like, stick that fucking paper in your mouth and fucking eat it.
Here we go, boys. That's it now. Let's go.
Oh my fucking Lord.
You'd mentioned Danico. Could you take him today?
Probably. I mean, why should things change?
Yeah.
Dano's a good guy.
Dano's a great guy.
Dano's funny too.
We had him on. We had Dano on. Yeah, he's a good guy. We can't leave the show. You had mentioned sort of halfway through, you got hours and hours and hours of stories. And we get, when Rusty was told he should write a book, he said, no, let's do a podcast. So we get to hear great stories all week from Rusty on this thing. You got to have a couple of favorites, Nux. Do I ever like calling you Nux? I feel like we're lifelong friends.
It's one of the best it's one of the best nicknames in sports. Yeah.
And I would have your back, Nux. Okay, yeah. If I was on that street corner in Boston, I'm a great receiver. Okay, I'd go in first.
My brother tells a story after he played for Boston. He said they were down at Thursdays and or Sir Winston's. Remember, you go down a few stairs and had the bar right in the middle. And he said you fucking threw a beer bottle. There's like five or six of them. You finished your beer and you fucking threw it right at them.
I still remember that one.
No, but you didn't.
I ended up going after Lumley once in the bar, right? I was with Mark Hunter and we were out one afternoon and Edmonton was in town. And Hans wanted to see his brother. So we stopped real quick at Thursdays. I hated being around guys in the other team.
We didn't do that back then. Yeah.
So I went in with Hans. He said hi to his brother and I'm standing there. And Dave Lumley was a teammate of my roommate in Halifax, Timmy Burke at University of New Hampshire. So Lumley thought he kind of knew me. And I'm standing there talking. Hunts was talking to his brother. I'm just standing there. All the oil is around. All of a sudden, he pours a little beer on my head. Just a little teeny bit. I turned around, cracked him. A guy, all the bombs up. Big Surge pulled me in there. What are you doing fighting on Thursday? Look, I told him what happened.
Fucking Surge was the best.
I played with him. And I just love Surge.
I refer to him and Pat Quinn as the two best men I met in hockey in my career. And their handshake was all you needed.
Yeah.
Those two guys, they were the best.
I met Pat Quinn, but I'm sure if I ever played for him, I would have went through any wall that was in front of me. I heard nothing but good things about him.
Yeah.
Before you go, I got it. You grew up in the days. I mean, you played pro hockey in the days when everyone wanted a ticket to training camp as much as they did to a Stanley Cup final because of the shit that was going to come down with guys trying to fight their way into the league. How about the poor fucking pricks who came into your team going, okay, who do I got to fight? And they point to you. I'm out.
It's funny. I remember Brubaker came in one year and John Brophy had him down in the American League. And John Brophy told him, I found out afterwards, Brophy told him, listen, you want a fucking chance of making Montreal, you got to go after that guy. I fought him fucking four times at training camp. It was ridiculous. I remember the last time I was on a 2-on-1 with Cabo and he was back checking and Cabo slid the puck over to me. I let the puck go and I went, boom, I fucking elbowed him right in the head. And then he went down and I just fucking, that was it. And Brew ended up going to Halifax, but I ended up liking Brew, but you know, the other guy, Brophy, put him up to it, like crazy John Brophy. I love Brof too, but it was hilarious.
Brew was my left winger in my my first full year in Toronto. I had Brew on left and Bob McGill on right.
Oh, Big Daddy, baby. Let's go. Daddy. All good guys, you know? Guys who do that job, honestly, like everybody says, who was the toughest guy? I never, ever. And listen, you heard guys, Proby, the toughest, isn't, and he was. I really believe that Clark Gillies one of the toughest guys ever played the game as far as a fighter. Like, he didn't fight all the time, but boy, when he did, I remember him and O'Reilly, when they give it to O'Reilly in Boston, Ed Hospodar, he fucking hit Ed Hospodar with three punches. He broke his fucking eye socket, his jaw, and knocked his fucking teeth out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Good aim. Yeah. That's good aim.
He fucking destroyed his face. And, you know, it's just like, you know, crazy shit. But, right. You know, all the guys who do that job, they were all tough. Yeah. You know, whatever. I just always try to, because I wasn't, you know, I'm only just about 6 feet. And I was 202 pounds, but I had to fight smart. If I didn't fight smart, if I was wide open all the time, man, you break your jaw, you know, that shakes your confidence. And I had to fight smart. I remember the first fight against Boston, I fought Jonathan and I fought O'Reilly afterwards. And I knew O'Reilly was a lefty.
Jesus.
So I knew he was a lefty. I said, fuck it, I'm going with him. Everybody at home's watching. I'm fucking going. And I threw it one punch and he hit me with two less before I got the next one off. Wow. And he hit me right in the button.
Uh-oh.
And I never broke my nose. 13 years, never broke my nose. My nose like rubber anyway.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He dinged me right and... You know, the water came, my blood pouring out of my head, and I stayed on my feet. But I got the penalty box, and I said to myself, you know, my pride was fucking just crushed. I'm like, oh, my hero fucking just kicked my ass. And I said to myself, I can never let that happen again. I got to fight smart. I got to start taking away guys' strength and picking my way through fights, because most of them guys, like, are all bigger than me. Sammy was when I fought him, Dave Brown, fucking O'Reilly, all of them. You know, Curran in Boston, Cochran in Philly, Chikrin in Philly. Like, a lot of big guys.
Big names, man, yeah.
I had to fight smart. And I had one friend of mine, Tom Regan. He said, listen, I'm watching you fight all the time. When you're throwing your uppercuts, you're fucking missing. Don't aim for the chin anymore. Aim for the chest. Oh. And I started aiming from the chest. He said, even if you miss, you hit the chest, you come off the chest, you hit him in the chin or the throat. And I just had to fight smart.
Fuck. We got to, before you go, Chris, you got to ask a guy who, and what a great interview this has been, a guy who fought his way in his career, knew his role,
loved it. As you said, grew up tough, played tough, would do anything. You'd walk through a wall for fucking guys. What do you think of the game now? As a tough guy that you were, I'm going, you can't like the fucking game now.
You know, this game is fast. You know, the red line being out, the league wants it fast. They don't want, I love Bobby Orr said, put the red line back in, make these guys pass their way out of the zone, come up the ice together. I miss coming up the ice together somewhat. As far as the fighting, be surprised. Not so much. I get it. I think it should always be in there for two guys who get so pissed at each other, they just had enough and they got to let it out.
Bingo.
But the other stuff, all that stuff we used to do, I it's never coming back. And with the visors and shit, but really, some of the talent today is really, man, it's you know, Rusty was fast, man. You know, I always thought, look, I remember James Patrick told me once, Knox, if you can skate, you can play in this league. And I worked on my skating every day. I chased Bob Gainey around the rink like you don't know. I would follow him. I try and lengthen my stride. He was such a great skater. But, you know, today they're so fast, everything at top speed. But it just, I don't know. Playoff hockey, usually a lot better than regular season.
Right.
But I don't think there's enough. And the league would like them. But when you have rivalries, man, like, fuck, we played Boston. We played four fucking exhibition season games. Two down there and two up here. Then we played fucking four down there during the season, and then they played four up here. We've seen them 12 times before the playoffs. You fucking hated each other. You know, the game is – listen, it's fast. It's good on some nights and other nights. It really – it just sucks. I think they play too many games. I think if they played about 70 and cut it back some, that you'd get better regular season games. But, man – fuck, we missed the boat on all the big fucking jet, 90 fucking movies to watch. You know, they got fucking breakfast. They stop practice, have a little fucking, they have a little sushi snack, and then they have fucking dinner for them. It's crazy, you know?
Well, thanks for coming on, you guys.
Listen, here's the deal. I'd be more than happy to do it again with you. I'm going to be, I think May 1st, Raw Knuckles is coming out. I had a bitch of a time coming up with a name. I thought it would be easy.
What is it? What's Ron Knuckles?
Podcast.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know who I'm doing the podcast with? Tim Stapleton. Stapes, he was on Spit and Chicklets here. Me and Stapes.
Oh, my gosh.
Doing it together. We've done about 12 episodes already that we have in the can. And we're going to start releasing May 1st. We've never met. Only on Zoom, me and Nate. We're meeting next Monday for about 5 days down in Pittsburgh. Cool. And we're going to get to know each other and kind of loosen up a little.
Chris Nyland, baby, this has been fantastic. Thanks a million, man. It's going to be a smash hit. We really appreciate you coming on. Good luck with everything. And thanks for your openness and honesty, man. It was great.
Jim, awesome stuff. Rusty, great to see you, pal.
Yeah, great to see you, bud.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to The Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.